This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome, I'm Peter Terzakian. It's the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for March 6, 2019.
And I'm Jackie Forrest.
Great, Jackie. So we've got three things to talk about today. They're all somewhat related. Pipelines are the big news again here in Canada. So we're going to talk about the delay in the Enbridge Line 3 replacement, get some more detail on that. And of course, that delay has implications for the rail and crude by rail, which we talked about a couple of podcasts ago.
Yeah. And while we're at it, let's update everyone on the other big oil pipelines that are coming and also delayed, but what the current status is and the outlook for timing.
Like the Trans Mountain and the Keystone XL.
Yeah, those are the big ones.
Those are the big ones. Okay, well, another big one is that Enbridge Line 3. It's been delayed again by something like a year. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, at the end of the year, you had a write-up about the Canadian oil industry's story is like a drama that unfolds and the plot is full of twists and turns. Well, yeah. Here's another twist we learned about last Friday, that this Line 3 replacement project will be delayed. And so originally the plan was for this pipeline, which is a replacement of an existing pipeline that has been around since the 1960s, and to replace it with a new pipeline. But by doing that, you're actually increasing the capacity of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Enbridge had put out a very specific date that it would be in operation November 1st, 2019, which, you know, in hindsight, maybe if you have a specific date like that, that's a signpost.
Well, the twist and turn, as we talked about, is almost guaranteed. But why don't you tell our audience exactly where this pipeline starts and where it goes and what is actually being replaced?
Okay, so this is part of the Enbridge Mainline system. And, you know, the Enbridge Mainline system is not just one pipeline. It's a very big group of pipelines. And it moves currently about 2.5 million barrels a day of oil out of Western Canada, or 70% of all the pipeline flows out of Western Canada.
So it's like the main artery for oil out of Alberta into the United States.
Yes, and there are many lines. They have names like Line 1, Line 2, Line 3, even Line 67, 55, there isn't some logic really to the numbers. But Line 3 has been around, you know, since the 1960s and runs 1,600 kilometers from Edmonton, crosses the border south of Winnipeg through Minnesota and ends in Superior, Wisconsin. And the problem right now in terms of the delay is this Minnesota is going to take longer to get these permits than first expected. And that's going to push back some of the other regulatory work.
Right.
So now they're saying second half, but a lot of it due to that U.S. state.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, people need to appreciate the regulatory complexity of getting a pipeline even approved for upgrading. I mean, it crosses multiple jurisdictions, in other words, provinces and states, international border between the Canada and the United States. So it's not a trivial undertaking to get approvals these days.
That's right. And even when the State Department at the federal level in the United States approves a pipeline, there is still permits needed from many different entities at the state level and even federal entities.
Right.
And so these all have to go through their process. And so, you know, it's not just Canada that has a lot of layers in terms of approvals.
Right.
The United States does as well.
So there's political approvals. That's not the issue here. There's regulatory approvals of all the regulatory agencies at the various levels of government. And then there's judicial, I'll call it, approvals or cases in the judiciary. So this has to do with regulatory.
Yes, with the permits associated at the state level.
Okay.
And then there are some federal permits like the Army Corps in the U.S., you know, that have to also issue permits.
Mm-hmm.
And the delay in the state level permits is sort of pushing back some of those other
That's the Wisconsin, is it, or Minnesota?
This is Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So now we're saying not sure exactly the date, but sometime in the second half of 2020, we will get this new pipeline capacity. Now, this is important because the other big pipelines are still a ways off. This project was the most near term. And as you know, we had those big differentials here in Western Canada. We have curtailments on our production right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so this pipeline was very important. And its timing is very consequential in terms of what it means for crude by rail movements out of Western Canada.
Right. So just to be clear, so the capacity in that Line 3 was what, and what was it supposed to go to before the end of this year?
Right. So the capacity right now is around 390,000 barrels a day. So not the whole main line, it's just one piece of it. But once they were finished, they would actually have a slightly larger pipe that could run under a higher pressure, and it would increase the capacity to 760,000 barrels a day. So basically adding 370,000 barrels a day more exit capacity from Western Canada.
The Line 3 incremental capacity is about the size of what, a Trans Mountain?
It's about 60% of a Trans Mountain.
That Trans Mountain expansion that we're waiting for.
Right.
And how much of a Keystone XL?
About 40% of a Keystone XL.
Yeah, so it's significant. More. It's not as big as either of those two, but it's significant.
It is significant. Now, the pipeline is a little different than those projects in that it would move more crude oil into the U.S. Midwest, mm-hmm. where those other projects are pointed towards other markets. Mm-hmm. Now, the Midwest is Canada's largest oil market. Now, this Line 3 capacity would not all be used in the Midwest. Some of that supply will probably eventually go to the U.S. Gulf Coast through connections that allow the crude to flow through the Enbridge system into other pipelines.
I mean, you know, you have to envision North America as almost like arteries and veins of all these different chemicals, petrochemicals, oil, natural gas, right? And so once you get it, the main artery to a big hub in the Midwest and the refineries, it can also be diverted down south to the Gulf Coast.
Right. Now, there's some capacity to do that today that does need to grow. But the expectation was, you know, when mm-hmm. this Line 3 came, there would then be some more expansion of those downstream systems as well.
Right.
It would expand the capacity out of Western Canada, get more crude to the Midwest, and eventually allow more crude to get into the U.S. Gulf Coast, which is the real growth market for Canadian oil.
And now it's delayed. Okay. So what is your prognosis in terms of it being delayed any more than the latter half of 2020?
Well, you know, I'm optimistic, and Cenovus made some comments like that this week as well, that now maybe there's more certainty in terms of the timing for these different permits and that we can maybe have more confidence in this new date, which is more broad. It's saying the second half of 2020. Mm-hmm. And so I ultimately think this pipeline will be built. It's just a matter of how long it will take. And in the meantime, though, we do need alternative ways to move our crude oil to market. And so that's where crude by rail is going to play a very important role.
I mean, I think the strategy of hoping that a pipeline is going to get built is rapidly running out. And the importance of diversifying the modality of how we get our oils to market is really important. And we've talked about that in previous podcasts, and we had James Cairns from CN here. And now, again, with this delay, it just highlights the importance of cementing a new supply chain that provides alternative modes of transport.
Right. And we talked a lot on the podcast about those big crude oil price discounts we saw in the end of 2018. And if there's a positive that came out of that, it was that it resulted in more commitments to crude by rail and financial mm-hmm. commitments, contracted volumes that will allow the rail companies to staff up, buy the locomotives, get the equipment they need. So a lot of that is in place. And that's a good thing because we will need most of the rail capacity that we have contracted as an industry and with the government as well mm-hmm. in order to fill the gap between now and when that Line 3 comes and we can take a little bit more crude out of Western Canada back onto pipeline.
So it's been a couple months since we've really talked about this in earnest, the curtailment, the differentials, the need for more rail cars to these refineries in the Midwest and even to the Gulf Coast. So can you give us a bit of a status update on where we are?
The Canadian oil market was oversupplied at the end of 2019, and we've actually gotten more data on the actual production levels now. And we do believe that we are pretty accurate when we estimated we were about 200,000 barrels a day oversupplied mm-hmm. at the end of the year. So that means that when we considered the amount of pipe capacity we had and the amount of rail, we were still producing about 200,000 barrels a day more than that. We are running as of December, so we actually have data on that now for crude by rail at 350,000 barrels a day. Crude by rail.
So 350,000 barrels a day is going out of the province on rail cars now.
As of December. And so at that time, you know, the government stepped in and curtailed production because we were getting these massive price discounts. We just didn't have any near-term solutions for moving that excess supply.
Right.
And so the idea was we would put these curtailments in place and then over the course of the year, as more rail capacity became available, we could release these curtailments and the crude by rail
and
could start to
clear the market.
And that
has happened a bit, right? I mean, the curtailment, the Notley government, I think, cut 75,000 barrels off the curtailment.
Right. So there was the December 2nd, the first time we announced mm-hmm. it was 325,000 barrels a day. Then they made another reduction in February, reduced to 250,000 barrels a day of mm-hmm. curtailment. And just recently, March 1st, announced that starting in April, they'll reduce that by another 25,000. Right. So we'll be down to 225,000 barrel a day curtailment starting in April.
So, you know, back a couple months ago, we predicted on this podcast that, by spring, it's going to ease up. That's happening. But now we've got this situation with the Line 3 being delayed out because the idea was that the easing of the curtailment and the bringing on of more rail would then naturally blend into the opening up of the pipeline in the fourth quarter of this year and smooth everything out. But now it looks like we're going to need even more rail. Is that fair?
That's exactly right. So this changes things now, because now what we're looking at is needing crude by rail to clear the market potentially for the first half of 2020 and maybe even a little longer, because we're not exactly certain in the timing when the pipeline would be operational. And so there has been, you know, some discussion that, well, maybe the curtailments need to be extended out because of this. There's a lot of uncertainty in trying to understand exactly how much supply will exist in 2020. Mm-hmm. But from our numbers, we think it's possible that we'll have enough rail capacity to clear the market and not need the curtailments.
So in terms of that rail, of course, as you mentioned earlier, it takes time for new locomotives to be commissioned or put on the tracks here. Well, especially also the cars, the specialized tanker cars that you need. And that both companies and now even the provincial government came out with the announcement that they're going to lease these cars and bring them here. Is that happening as we speak? Is there, what is the status of that?
Yes. So
what's your understanding of that?
And this is the really important thing. We had the 350,000 barrels a day of movements in December, so we know that's possible. And then since then, you know, we have other announcements from industry and government, which we believe gets the crude by rail capacity closer to 600,000 barrels a day when we add on the new supply. And to give you an idea of how long it takes, how important it is to make these commitments early, the government, you know, recently announced their crude by rail commitment, but their first crude by rail wouldn't be moving until July. And even then, it would only be 20,000 barrels a day of the 120,000 barrel a day commitment they made. And it would actually be into 2020 before they would reach their peak capacity. And that's how long it takes to put together all the pieces you need. And so it's not just instant. That's part of why we're in the situation we're in right now, because we had too much supply and the crude by rail isn't going to come on in a month. It takes some time to get that in place.
I think the good news is that the mentality of diversifying, as I said, the modality of transportation really set in. And toward the end of last year, when we had those massively wide differentials, and is that the strategy of hope, as I call it, for more pipelines sort of eroded. And now, you know, my sense is that given that Line 3 is delayed, there's even a greater sense of urgency. Call it crude by rail. And in past programs, I've said, you know, it's like basically a unit train, which is nothing but tanker cars, is like a pipeline on wheels. Right? And it's really a different modality of carrying a large slug of oil down to the markets.
Yeah. So the big question in terms of looking towards 2020, and you know, there's some uncertainties here. It's mm-hmm. how things will unfold. The first uncertainty from my perspective is how much supply will come on mm-hmm. over the next year. And,
new production, like from the oil sands company.
Exactly. So we know that we had 200,000 barrels a day extra production at the end of the year.
Right.
But as the curtailments come off, could there even be more supply there? And there's two major projects that we're watching. One is Cenovus's Christina Lake G project. They've actually talked recently, even this week, about potentially delaying the startup of that. Mm. But that could add capacity. And there's also another new project by CNRL called the Kirby North that could add capacity. It's slated to come on at the end of 19. Now, it's important to remember that these projects, they don't just run at their full capacity. These in-situ projects, they slowly ramp up. And so depending on when they start up and the ramp-up time, that affects our outlook for supply. The other uncertainty
is... it's hopefully there's some sort of lesson learned toward the end of last year that bringing on big slugs of new production clobbers the market. I sense that there's potentially more sort of a scheduling mentality and timing given this news that the pipe is going to be delayed.
Right. So that's the real uncertainty, but hopefully you're right. And the good news is Cenovus did put out some comments already this week that they mm-hmm. could look at that timing. Their project is actually scheduled to start producing in the middle of 2019. Mm-hmm. And so it is, depending on, you know, their decisions and how fast mm-hmm. that ramps up, that can change your view. Another piece that's hard to forecast is the conventional side of our oil industry. There's a lot less drilling going on this year. And we've seen some shut-ins in the heavy oil area. And so that will actually reduce supply potentially over what we had at the end of 2018.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the drilling levels are really very low right now. And the amount of investment that's been coming in as a consequence of those very wide differentials. So it's going to pick up. We've talked about that on this podcast before, but not before really the latter half of this year, which then is a lag in terms of offsetting any declines in the conventional basis into 2020.
Exactly. And that is helpful in that it means less oil needs to move by crude by rail to clear the market. And then there's another uncertainty around the potential for expansions to the existing pipeline system. So although we can't put in the Line 3 replacement project, Enbridge, which owns the main line and also some other pipeline systems that leave Western Canada, has put forward some plans to increase their throughput in 2019. And those are going to be important as well to help move some of the incremental growth that may be coming from the oil sands. So it depends when the Line 3 comes online, like if it's the middle of 2020 or the very end of 2020, that affects the numbers. So, you know, I just want to say that there's lots of uncertainties here. I think crude by rail should be enough to clear the market, but it'll depend on how some of these things unfold.
So here's the multi-billion dollar question for you. Like, what do you think is the probability of having really wide differentials again, like we had in November, December last year?
I would say it's low because, as we talked about, the conventional supply is declining, assuming the oil sands producers are a little more moderate in terms of their ramp up.
And
of
the
these
storage
was
drawing down, right? The storage levels were drawing down.
Well, actually, storage has not drawn down as much as people had expected in the first quarter of the year. We're not quite there yet, but looking at where we're going in terms of the end of the month. And that's partly because the rail movements have fallen from the December level. And so we haven't really drawn the inventories down as much as we expected.
Yeah, so I'm keying in on your word of uncertainty. I mean, there's just a lot of uncertainty, it just seems to me, certainly for 19, extending into 2020. I mean, you know, there is going to be stability at some point in terms of these literally growing pains and the repiping of the continent, because this is not only an issue here. I mean, there's not many other parts of the United States that are being repiped because of the dramatic production growth. But, you know, waiting around for pipelines, as I said, is a bit of a strategy of hope. So let's talk about that hope for the other pipelines.
Okay. So update on other pipelines. So there's two other major pipelines that are potentially going to be built here in the next 2 to 3 years out of Western Canada. The TMX pipeline expansion. So this is an existing pipeline that flows 300,000 barrels a day from Alberta to Burnaby, BC. And there's a plan to expand that to 890,000 barrels a day. So that would add 590,000 barrels a day of additional capacity. Oh, by the way, there's the good comparison to rail. It's about the same size as the TMX expansion is what we're talking about for rail.
Yeah, no, it's huge, the amount of rail. So this pipeline, the Trans Mountain, I mean, it's been around, I think, since late 50s. And it's been an artery from Alberta to the West Coast. There was a refinery on the West Coast.
Yes, and also supplies a lot of U.S. West Coast refineries. There's a fair amount of refineries just over the border into Washington State. And so it's a very important crude source for those refineries as well.
Right. So they're looking to expand it. And I think by now we all know the story in terms of the delays and the geopolitics of Canada.
Right. So the federal government is now the owner of the existing pipeline.
Yes, it's been nationalized. So we are waiting to hear anxiously the next chapter in this drama.
Right. And there has been some news here. February 22nd, there was a report issued by the NEB that addressed some of the marine issues. So to back up, in August, there was a setback for this project when the court ruled that the federal government did not carry out its duty to consult with First Nations and Indigenous people, and at the same time didn't consider how the project would affect the marine environment. And so the first piece of that, you know, dealing with that challenge is this NEB report that was released February 22nd that basically ruled that the project should be approved, but it would be subject to some additional recommendations and requirements over top of what was already required. It had something like 156 recommendations that the NEB said, you know, should over top of the regulatory requirements that should be done in order for the project to move forward. And now there's 16 more that have come from this look at the marine issues.
Right. So we don't need to go into all the detail. The National Energy Board is the federal regulatory body that opines and accredits the construction, sanctioning of new projects. And so we've got this one hurdle yet to go, which is the consultations with the Indigenous people.
Well, there's a couple, I don't know if they're hurdles, but a couple other things to watch for. The federal government now has 90 days to reach their final decision. So basically the NEB has the authority to recommend that the pipeline move forward with some conditions. But the federal government, the cabinet, has to actually approve that. So they have 90 days now right. to approve that. So that's one thing that we're waiting for. But you're right. The second piece then is to address the court's other concern around the First Nations consultation.
And yeah, boy. I mean, this is such a talk about uncertainty in this one, too. I mean, we've got a federal election upcoming. We've got this SNC-Lavalin mess that's occupying a lot of time in Ottawa. And we're waiting to hear something from the cabinet in Parliament.
Associated with this approval within the next 90 days.
I mean, is this realistic? I mean, I don't know. I have an opinion on these sorts of things in terms of where they're going, but I have no idea, like given all the uncertainty out there. And you talk to 10 different people and you're going to get at least 10 different opinions on whether or not this thing is going to go. The hope I know for here in Alberta in the election is that there's going to be shovels in the ground before what is expected to be a May provincial election. So we shall see.
The one real uncertainty is this First Nations consultation. We don't really have a time frame for how long that will take. Yeah. We know it's actively ongoing. Yeah. You know, it'll just be a question of when that gets all wrapped up. And could we start to see shovels in the ground this summer? If so, realistically, this pipeline could start in the 2021 time period.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, I'll just say it again. We've said it in previous podcasts that, you know, between the Line 3, the Lays, TMX, Keystone XL, which we'll talk about in a minute, like it is forcing the industry to diversify into the alternative modalities so that we have more than one, I'll call it pipe in the basket, not egg in the basket, because it's so essential. Like we had no optionality. We were just sort of hostage to these externalities, whether it's regulatory approvals here across the border, judicial issues, you know, lawsuits, whatever. So, like, we need alternatives.
And it's
happening. So that's if there's anything positive that's to come out of all this, is that it's creating flexibility and alternative modalities.
Well, and, you know, as we had that podcast from February 8th with CN, James Carnes, mm-hmm. talking about the potential for rail to become more economic, maybe even comparable to pipeline. And so there's some opportunity there, I think, over the course of the next few years to see more efficient, more economic rail start to play a long-term role here in Western Canada.
Yeah. And I mean, whether it's becoming more efficient with the scheduling and logistics of a unit trains to, as James told us a couple weeks ago, to completely different supply chain management of what you put in rail cars, you know, pure bitumen versus diluted bitumen, to significantly lower your costs. So, you know, it's forcing the industry to diversify the modality and also be innovative to drive down costs. So, last one, Keystone XL.
Keystone XL, interesting. This is a week where former President Obama came to visit Calgarians.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to remind all Calgarians that he actually was pretty instrumental in canceling the Keystone XL quite arbitrarily near the end, in my view. But here we are. The President Trump brought it back from the dead and got it going as soon as he got into office. This is an 830,000 barrel a day bullet line to Texas that has been about a decade in the making. And there's a huge opportunity here because there is a real shortage of heavy crude on the U.S. Gulf Coast. The good thing about rail actually is it can get us there today, but this is the only pipeline that's sort of a direct route to the world's largest heavy oil market that is short heavy oil supply.
It's short from Venezuela, right? I
mean, that's right. It was actually already short because of the decline in Mexico as well as Venezuela. But now with the U.S. government's policy that effectively doesn't allow imports of Venezuelan oil. Yeah. It's very short heavy oil. So there's a real need there on the Gulf Coast for Canadian oil. And Keystone XL could play a very important role in terms of delivering Canadian oil to that important market.
But it's uncertain too, not only with regulatory issues, but also now lawsuits and things.
Right. So it's suffering a little bit like the TMX from a court challenge. So there was a regulatory decision on it, but the court has now challenged actually a court in Montana. We talked about this on an earlier podcast and found issues with the environmental review. And it's now causing the State Department to have to do some additional work. And there's also some issues in Nebraska where the Supreme Court is going to reach a decision. It's expected sometime, maybe in the next month, there's been an appeal over the pipeline route. You know, did they choose the right pipeline route? Did they do the right work that they needed to do to evaluate the impacts of a new pipeline route?
Yeah.
And so there's some issues there. Now, TransCanada has reported recently that it needs 2 summer seasons to complete construction, and it's still uncertain if they'll be in the position to start construction this summer because of uncertainties around these 2 issues.
Boy, so if it's a 2-year construction cycle, then we're getting into the federal election in the United States.
That's right. So if you could construct this summer, you could actually have
finish this thing
completed under Donald Trump's time in office. But if you can't construct this summer, you know, you would be only constructing 1 season when you need 2. So the second part would be constructed under,
whoever.
You know, it could be Donald Trump, or of course it could be a Democratic leader as well.
Yeah, we know the politics are so important in terms of determining the outcome of these major infrastructure projects relating to oil.
So yeah, what's really critical on this one is to sort of watch what unfolds here over the next 2-3 months to understand if there will be construction started this summer.
Right. Well, it's huge in terms of capacity, but in terms of, you know, this never-ending saga of delaying the pipeline through judicial or regulatory means, really not one barrel of oil from Alberta has been actually curtailed in terms of going to the United States. If you look at a chart of oil exports to the United States, they've been steadily going up.
They have, up until, you know, now when we've started
to curtail. Yeah, we've got a bit of a localized curtailment.
Yes.
But it's in terms of hindering the flow across the border, that's really hasn't been an issue.
No, we've been growing and growing in terms of our supply of heavy oil to the United States. A lot of that's been facilitated by growth in the Enbridge mainline, which has been able to debottleneck and add capacity. And we're actually expecting more of that this year with the plans that they've put forward for incremental improvements, either through a small debottlenecking. And so that continues to grow. And now with the crude by rail, I think we're going to see
even more.
Quite a lot of oil moving to the U.S. this year and into the very important Gulf Coast region. I mean, that's one great thing about rail. It can access all those refineries on the Gulf Coast and can target, you know, those refineries that need it. Not all of them are pipeline
connected. And importantly, the ones that are willing to pay the highest price. And so this really comes to the crux of it is that, you know, none of these delays have prevented oil going to the United States, but it has resulted in Canadians not getting the full value for their oil because of the differential issue. And that is really what we're ultimately seeking, is to get paid full value for our oil on a consistent long-term basis without these wide differential blowouts.
That's right. And today, the modality of crude by rail that we do use does require larger discounts from our crude oil to those benchmarks in the U.S. than what we would have if we had pipe.
Right.
Of course, we've talked about how that can change,
but
there is an economic cost today for using crude by rail for every barrel in the basin because it sets the price differently here.
Right. Well, I think we've covered it. Thank you very much for listening, and we shall be back next week with our next ARC Energy Idea podcast. So from Peter Terzakian and
Jackie Forrest,
we'll see you next time.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.